This is Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
On February 27, 2007, the Albemarle County Planning Commission held a work session to receive an update on the Places 29 Master Planning Project. When complete, the Places 29 Master Plan will provide a 20-year vision for the Route 29 North Corridor, detailing the development, transportation, and public facilities desired by the community. The commissioners received the recently completed draft plan, which has been under development since the first public workshops were held in May 2005. The Places 29 Master Plan is scheduled to be adopted in late 2007 by the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. This recording by Charlottesville Tomorrow begins with a call to order by Chairman Marcia Joseph, who introduces Albemarle County Senior Planner Judy Wiegand to start the presentation.
Okay, we will go ahead and convene. Thank you, Judy. I'm sorry. Thank you for being so patient.
Oh, no problem.
And it wasn't the traffic that held me up, so I don't have an excuse, but thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. This is a Places 29 work session. I'm Judy Wiegand, a member of the Community Development staff, and I'd like to briefly introduce who we have out here. Of course, Harrison Rue, that you know, the Executive Director of the Planning District Commission. Phil Erickson, who's the principal with Community Design and Associates. Fred Dock, Meyer Mohadas and Associates, the Transportation Planners. John Giametti from VDOT, whom I'm sure you've also seen many times. And of course, you know Jack Kelsey. Thomas Kronemeyer, another person from our CDNA, our design consultants. And Kathy Galvin in the second row, who's a local architect and planner, but who's working with part of the consultant team. And I think I got everybody there. Our purpose today in having the work session is to continue to assist the commission in understanding the Places 29 Master Plan and the transportation study, where it came from and what's in it. You've asked a number of questions at several previous work sessions, and so we have the consultants with us today to help with the update and to help answer your questions. I'd like to begin with a few comments about the public workshop that we had last night. Oh, good, it's working. This was the general goal of the workshop and the framework. We are working on creating places to live, work, and recreate, to increase people's choices for housing, transportation, and the lifestyles they lead, and to also promote sustainability for both the current residents and future generations. I'm going to go through sort of where we've come from. We had some prior work that was done that's led up to Places 29. We've had the Planning District Commission has worked on regional sustainability accords and the Eastern Planning Initiative. We've had a number of award-winning local plans, one the Albemarle County Neighborhood Model, another the Charlottesville Commercial Corridor Plan. There's also, of course, the Regional Transportation Plan known as UNJAM that was adopted in 2004 and forms part of the underpinning for the transportation study. Then we also have Phase 1 and Phase 2 of the 29H250 project that explored similar concepts with the city, the county, VDOT, and the MPO between 2003 and 2005. And the final draft of Phase 2 is actually forms the basis for this, for the transportation study. From the master plan standpoint, we had a community visioning workshop in May 2005, an existing conditions workshop in November of 2005, and then we followed that up with the three framework concepts that we analyzed in the day, 2 days later in November. Then we also had public workshops number 4 and 5 to review those framework alternatives in May of last year. Which brings us up to last night, where we had a public workshop for the draft preferred framework plan. We presented it to the public. The next steps that we're looking at are having a final draft of the master plan late in the spring, and there will also at the same time be a regional transit authority plan that will be being developed between now and later in the spring. And then we're also still in the public review and comment period on the final draft master plan that we expect to take place between summer and fall of this year. and eventually we hope to have the master plan adopted late this year. We've had some key input from the last meetings before the one last night. Relating to land use, people have talked about housing. They've expressed general appreciation for or support for employment and mixed-use centers in our framework map. They like the idea of the uptown and redevelopment of older retail malls. They stressed that they were interested in fewer big boxes but better services and retail opportunities, and they very much wanted increased open space and parks integrated into neighborhoods. From the transportation perspective, the key input has been that they really like the parallel routes, especially Berkmar. They're important and they should be lower speed. They wanted bridges or underpasses, not the traditional freeway interchange with US 29 or all over US 29. They stressed that they wanted bus service to the airport and on both the east and west sides of 29. An improved environment from walking and landscape buffers along US 29 that would provide a nice access and for pedestrians and bicycles. Last night we had a series of small groups in work session. They reviewed the draft framework plan, and we wanted them to tell us whether we got it right and to also identify some priorities for implementation. When we got to the workshop, we had between 80 and 90 participants at 12 tables, each facilitated. About 50% of the people who were at the meeting were new to the process, which gave us a very interesting perspective because we got to hear some questions repeated. We got some interesting perspectives as well. Many of them were from the surrounding rural areas, such as the Earliesville Road area. They expressed a lot of appreciation for the level of detail, the amount of work to date. They liked the maps. They particularly liked some of the large highway diagrams, the Road 29 diagrams that we had posted for them, and that we're planning to put up in the hallway here so the commission will have a chance to look at them starting in the next few days. Most of the people there stayed all the way to the end of the program, which was shortly after 9 o'clock. The feedback we got was a real diversity of opinions, primarily due to the fact that we had people who were there for the first time, as well as a number of people who'd been to several of the sessions previously. There were several recurring comments that we've identified so far. The first one was that people wanted us to fix the 29 US 250 bypass area. They also expressed a wish to have us invest in parallel roads, and they also stressed transit. Some of them thought it was a great idea, let's get started. Others expressed an uncertainty about whether it was feasible, whether people would use it. So before, we're going to be preparing a full summary of all the 12 workbooks that came from the session last night, and we basically that's all the comments we're prepared to give about what we heard last night, because we don't want to give undue stress to some where we may have read that comment so far, but we haven't really gone through all the workbooks yet. And we want to incorporate what we hear from the neighborhood meetings that will be held next week. That's the point where we expect to get some more information about individual neighborhoods and how they think about the things that are happening in their neighborhood, as opposed to the overall look that we got last night. Okay. So I'm going to, at this point, turn the mic over to Harrison Rue, and he's going to give you a little bit of a perspective on the transportation study part of this.
The 30-second version, just a reminder, we showed it on the initial slide, that this is not only – for about the last year or so, you've been reviewing work product related to the county's framework plan, but we brought before the public again – this is the right time to paste in the prior work from 29 to 250 area. So the transportation modeling and the project diagrams include that area of the city all the way down to just the other side of the 250 bypass. So when Fred is talking about that, remember your role as both county folks commenting on the, in the county area, but considering the regional travel needs. We've got John Giametti here from VDOT looking at that. We, as you remember from the beginning of the study, we've seen this as both the regional corridor, highway of national significance, as well as our main street for Albemarle County. So Fred will go into the details of that. Phil will start off with land use, but interestingly enough, when we presented the land use and green infrastructure to folks last night, they immediately started working on transportation. They didn't wait for that presentation. So when Fred presented, so that's one of the reasons why we want to wait and have your questions at the end, because see the whole thing before you respond.
Bill.
And then you're the Planning Commission, so I know you'll be really engaged in the land use aspects of what we've been doing. What we're going to do, Fred and myself are going to walk through elements of the presentation that we had last night and bring you up to speed with where we are on the project at this point. So I'm going to go ahead and start with the land use discussion. So we have prepared now a draft framework plan, and this is an overview of that from the south end on the left-hand side of the image at the 250 bypass up to the river, the South Fork of the Ravanna River in the middle there, and then up through Hollymead and past Piney Mountain. And what you see here is the land use pattern of centers, the mixed-use centers. Those are all the little letters that you see there. Are labeling the centers in the brown sort of brick color with the hatching. And then the range of neighborhoods that we've developed. And one of the things to keep in mind here, again, is that the neighborhoods that we're talking about are both residential, but there's also mixed-use neighborhoods and employment neighborhoods as well. So we're really thinking about an entire structure that's walkable and bikeable. One of the reasons for doing that is we're also working towards making the area transit ready. And that's what this image shows. The blue line running down US 29 with the circles, the idea of that is that could be a bus rapid transit system, possibly even in the longer term, a streetcar system running down US 29. And some of the earlier alternatives that we did, we looked at ways of having that mainline service on one side of US 29 or the other, given some of the access concerns about getting people right to 29. But we have refined that concept now to look at having the mainline run down the corridor, organizing some of the major centers along that. And then at the south end and then also at the north end of the areas, having a circulator service that would link together both sides of 29 and the concentrations of the centers around Rio and back down towards Hydraulic, and then in the north, Hollymead Town Center up through North Point and into the UVA Research Park. Again, just to remind you, the different center types that we're looking at on the left-hand side of this image is the four main center types that we've been using as building blocks for the centers of the neighborhoods, and then the different types of neighborhoods. And you can see on the bottom there sort of the color key that relates back to the framework plan. So again, just a little bit of a refresher course on the center types and neighborhood types. The smallest of the centers that has a mixed use to it is what we've called the neighborhood service center. And the idea of these is that's where there's the convenience type uses, maybe a small cafe, laundromat. You might have some limited amount of professional office in these locations. The idea of a center that people in the surrounding neighborhood or in the employment area can walk to take care of some of their everyday services. This is a simulation that we did looking at an area out along the western side of Rio Road where there's the series of gas stations. You can see there a real estate office. So, you know, possibly some of the uses that we're thinking about in a neighborhood center, but not necessarily in a walkable configuration, and the street itself doesn't really support those walkable connections. So what are things that we can do to the design of the street to calm the traffic, create a street that people feel comfortable biking along, walking along, and crossing to get to that center? And then how might that center grow over time into a more mixed-use place? Those might be residences above retail. It could be office space above retail. And then, again, what we're doing is building a place that over time the public can invest in transit service and other ways to help increase people's mobility in the area. And you can see in the middle of that image there, you could still have a gas station there, but it's just relocated in a way that it's creating an environment that, again, is comfortable for people to walk and bike in. An example of what an employment neighborhood center might look like. So this idea that you want to look to establish some mixed-use places within areas that are primarily for employment use. And the idea of these is that then people, that supports people's choice to carpool or take transit to work. You don't end up being stranded in an office park and not being able to get to any services during the day because now there's a mixed-use center that you can walk to. Community centers are sort of the next size up, and the idea of these is this is where there would be grocery stores, other kinds of uses that would draw from a larger area. So people might take transit, might bike from farther away, drive their car from farther away to come to the retail services that are in this area, but it's still designed in a way that it's walkable for the people who are right adjacent to it. So this is an idea of what one of those might look like. And how could that grow then? We've done a simulation here of Albemarle Square, but we've looked at a whole variety of the retail centers in the corridor, talked with some of the owners of different centers, and there is a potential for this type of development to occur over time. So how does this work? So there's the parking lot. Maybe initially some development can go into the parking lot. There might be structured parking back in behind those buildings. And then over time, as uses change, leases run out, there's the opportunity to incrementally build up one of these mixed-use community centers. In the northern part of the corridor, there are some. There's a community center that's located in North Point. So there's some that will start as mixed-use places, but there is the opportunity to see these kinds of changes over time. I've skipped over the destination center. That's an area where there might be a little bit more entertainment-type use, some larger retail-type uses, to focus on the uptown. And this was something that we talked about in the different alternatives that were presented last May. And given the feedback that we got from people during that meeting and thinking about it from a market viability standpoint, how the uptown might be able to mature over time, we've located the uptown, the most intense place in the plan, off of Airport Road. So it's just to the north of Airport Road. Part of it is within the UVA Research Park, and then it extends to the west of that. And this is a place where you would get the more intensive uses. We're thinking that the way that the comprehensive plan elements might be defined in this, that you might allow 6, maybe even up to 8-story buildings in a place like this. Again, a mix of office, housing, retail. This might be the place where you get a little bit more entertainment-type uses, restaurants, green spaces, the place that people would go to maybe hang out in the area as the place matures over time. And it also functions very importantly in terms of transit. So it's in a regionally important place next to the airport, the employment uses that are growing around it. It can be accessed possibly by the BRT system. That local circulator would pass by it and through it. So, again, really the opportunity to build a land use pattern that can support transit over time. A new element of the plan that we've been working on is the green infrastructure plan. It's very important. We've heard, again, a lot from the community. This is also an element that was done in Crozet. Is the idea of being more specific about the open space system and network within the Places 29 area. So this shows public parks, open spaces that might be under the control of a homeowners association but are open for people to walk along trails, local recreation within neighborhoods, all of those kinds of elements. The plan also gets into, there's a legend there in the lower right-hand corner, I've actually never counted all of them. I think there's probably about 10 different types of indications of the trail system that we're thinking of having within the Places 29 area. We've heard a lot about people having an interest in multi-use trails and bicycle improvements, both for recreation but also to get somewhere to take care of trips that you might otherwise do by driving. So that is detailed throughout the area. other elements of the green and sustainable approach that we're looking at developing within the plan as we start to move into preparing the unified guidelines and other elements of the master plan are ideas about building with topography. There's a lot of rolling topography in this area, steep slopes that create some of those open space opportunities, but other places where there are, you know, some fairly significant slopes, but we believe that there are ways to work with the development community so that they can be more sensitive to that existing topography. So on the bottom there, you see a way to think about developing a single-family fabric on a sloping site. The photo right above that is multifamily, probably in the range of 25, 30 units to the acre built on a sloping site. And then the idea that the street landscape can serve a multitude of functions. It provides shade, buffering for pedestrians, but it can also work as part of the infrastructure of the Places 29 area. So these are examples of landscaping that works to clean stormwater runoff and also help retain peak flows. So we're thinking about ways of using both streetscape and open spaces to serve those kinds of functions. Again, the trail network ranges from sidewalks and bicycle lanes on the one hand to more urban multi-use paved trails. And then there will also be more natural trails in some parts of the area connecting out to the systems that go out into the rural areas. A different scale of open space, this other center type that I didn't talk about earlier, the idea of having civic greens, that we've been very careful about where we've located retail uses within the plan. There's a tendency sometimes to think of the neighborhood model as something where a center needs to have those retail services. But that can get you into trouble where you end up having some nice, beautifully designed vacant space on the ground floors of buildings. We want to avoid that. So one of the ideas is that there is this other scale, that you can have a neighborhood that has a green, a park in the middle of it, maybe some civic uses that, again, creates a center and an identity for the neighborhood, but provides a different level of amenity for those areas. And on the green infrastructure plan, those are indicated by these green asterisks, as well as some of the other smaller parks that would be integrated into centers. So after running through that kind of explanation of where we are and the thoughts that have led to it, we gave the people last night the opportunity to go through these questions. And as Judy mentioned, that a lot of them immediately jumped to thinking about transportation, but we did get a lot of feedback on the land use plan, and we'll be digesting that more and coming up with some refinements to the plan. I expect we'll hear quite a bit more detail from the public on that in the neighborhood sessions next week, when people will really be focused, I think, a little bit more on their local experience in the Places 29 area. So let me turn it over to Fred to talk about some of the transportation choices.
Thanks, Bill. Good afternoon. Wanted to start with a little bit in terms of the way we'd introduced the transportation section to the group last night was to continue focusing on some of the transportation-related opportunities that could be brought to us, thinking about it in terms of how to link it with land use, how the transportation system is both influenced by and influences some of the land use decisions in the corridor. So we started with a slide that tried to bring out this concept of creating opportunities for new places and linking that within the overall framework of the discussion. Followed that with then a very brief look at another one of the photo simulations that thinks about a place that would be created by the transportation system where we'd able to accomplish the Berkmar extension across the South Fork of the Rivanna. So here's a before shot looking at the north end of the Sam's Club parking lot. With that bridge extension, with the road extension, it could possibly change to something that looks like this that could be populated within the mixed-use center nomenclature by these types of buildings ultimately to be able to sort of illustrate sort of the range of opportunities that the parallel route network could provide for us. The issue also then was also brought forward of dealing with the framework for bicycles and pedestrians, and this was used to illustrate that. We recapped a little bit of the information that went into building the study and some of the modeling and data development that we'd done for the program to understand what kind of trip making goes on in the corridor, just to remind people that there is a regional roadway system at hand here. There's also, it has a very large local function as well, and so we use these three slides to recap. We'd shown these a couple of times previously. I think you've probably seen them before, but essentially looking at through trips in the corridor that want to go all the way through without a stop in the middle represents about 12 to 15% of the overall daily travel on the corridor. The second component of trips that we were pulling out to illustrate to people are those that have one end in the corridor. These could be trips that you think of as either in commuting or out commuting, but basically they're corridor-based trips, but they want to leave the county at some point or leave the corridor area for the other urbanized portions of Albemarle County. This represents about 25% of the trips. So between these and the through trips, we're up to about 40% of the overall travel, which leaves us with about 60% of the trips on a daily basis or actually have both ends in the corridor or in the urbanized portion of Charlottesville, so that we're seeing a lot of local trip making, which is related to the level of retail and employment that's in the corridor. So we were trying to use this to reinforce the perception by people that all of the traffic on 29 is through traffic, when in reality, large portions of it are locally destined to begin to organize this. This is also then the underpinning for why the parallel route network that we've been talking about as a strategy for this corridor is so important, is to be able to provide a non-US 29 way to get around between the centers to satisfy some of this 60% of the overall demand. That then led us to a discussion of the roadway network that has been developed through the framework plan as well as through the corridor plan. We wanted to focus on US 29 and the alternative routes, the parallel networks that really form the core of the system. Those are focused, as you can see here, in a series of three or four, actually five, areas along the corridor. We have the 29H250 improvements at the south end that involve also Hillsdale Drive. Moving up, we are proposing a treatment around Rio Road that would also involve some changes in that area, but also rely heavily upon a parallel network. There is then the extension of Berkmar to begin to form that parallel route on the west side of US 29 all the way up into the airport and Hollymead areas. And then as we look up the corridor, we're beginning to introduce some actual improvements on 29 itself as we go north of the South Fork of the river in those areas where it's still four lanes divided between Hollymead and the Polo Grounds, as well as north of airport up to the North Fork of the river moving forward. Some of the process then, looking at this, was then to begin illustrating some of the alternate routes that continue to be worked through that show up in the framework plan that are a little bit further away from the network, but they also provide the connectivity necessary to be able to reach 29 and to cross 29. The green streets in this case are representative of those ones that are somewhat optional and that they already have other parallel routes that either existing or in the red networks. Lastly, the level of information then had to do with developing some of the street connections that go beyond the 2025 nature of the plan. These happen to do with other connections that are in the UNJAM regional transportation plan but are not being modeled as part of the initial 2025 corridor plan for US 29. Within the development of this particular network and the way it's shown on the screen right now, we did do quite a bit of modeling, looking at a variety of alternatives within the corridor, balancing those out. If you hark back to the work that was done for the alternatives development, there were a series of three alternatives that were modeled heavily at that. We had done 10 alternatives before that, just at a very minimal level of detail, but all of those looked at potential parallel routes, looked at the effect of Earliesville and Dickerson Roads, the potential connections of Prophet Road around the east side, and all of those were then used to determine what level of potential improvement or change on US 29 might result from the development of these parallel road systems. As those were filtered down into the preferred alternative that we're working with right now, we've basically come down into a much closer spaced road network that involves Berkmar and many of the roads in the area south of the river, south of the South Fork. But in the northern sections, we're focusing more on the western connections, other than in the area around North Point, where those roads would be shown as being parallel on the east side as well. So I can answer more of those as we get into questions, but did want to remind you that we have quite a bit of technical underpinning for how this works, and we can explain sort of the relative differences between what different links in the network represent. These concepts, then, are basically focusing on a series of improvements on US 29, improvements to the parallel road systems to essentially to make the network connections, to provide connectivity across US 29, and to be able to essentially provide a more uniform travel environment along the corridor to be able to meet some of the travel time goals of the project. To do this, a series of grade separations were introduced. One of those you've seen quite a bit about before. It has to do with the intersection at Hydraulic and US 29, where a grade separation or interchange was actually introduced as part of the 29H250 project. What's happening and what you'll see here as we move forward is that the concepts have been brought forward from the more conventional types of improvements at 29 and 250 in terms of improving the ramping, improving the interchange to be able to reduce the bottlenecks that are currently in place there, to this more tight urban design, urban interchange design, single point urban, interchange that was proposed for Hydraulic, where 29 would be brought under Hydraulic, would be to provide the design shown on the screen here. This is essentially the 29H250 scenario as we moved out of the city into the county. The next intersection up the corridor to the north that we were working with then that needed some level of improvement beyond conventional at-grade approach is Rio Road. And Rio, as opposed to approaching this from the development of an interchange at this location, which we did look at, we essentially have moved back to a different type of a concept here that really fits into the development of a midtown and the development of the different types of centers that you see on the framework plan that ring the Rio Road intersection, and have essentially created an overcrossing at Rio. It has some minimal ramping to provide for some of the higher volume movements, in other words, northbound on Rio to northbound on US 29, but the reverse in the other direction. But essentially has a limited amount of ramping associated with it to minimize the footprint. The other movements that would need to take place here would then be accomplished by the parallel road connections that are shown or outlined in blue here, including the piece of Berkmar that's not colored because it's existing. But those essentially would allow us to wrap together sort of three intersections from Shoppers World all the way up to Albemarle Square into a very tightly knit ring road that goes around the Rio intersection. I guess I don't have a pointer, but the concept here is that if you were going to make a left turn at Rio Road, you would essentially accomplish that by doing it. Maybe there's one there. By making right turns, if you can sort of. Oh, I can use the arrow on the planner. Oh, that's right. I got one right here. Sorry. If you're seeing the mouse. So if you were going to be making this left turn today, there's a couple of different ways to do that in this scenario, one of which is to come in and do it this way. The other direction is to come all the way up and just make three right turns to be able to use this parallel network. Part of this is that, and the reason we arrived at this type of an approach to the corridor is that as the demand grows on US 29 in the future and as the area around the corridor develops and redevelops, the need to turn traffic on and off the corridor is going to grow. And the ability to accommodate those turns becomes severely compromised as we get intersections get bigger and bigger on US 29. By going to this type of a circulation pattern with crossovers and right in, right off, access ramps to 29, you're able to distribute those volumes over several points as opposed to a single point. In this case, there are at least three different places where you'd want to turn left at Rio Road to go westbound. You could actually do that at three different places along the corridor here to accomplish that same move. So it begins to provide a way to disperse and distribute some of the traffic that currently concentrates at the big intersections. It also provides a way to bring traffic through the parallel road system to make those parcels desirable from a development standpoint and to meet to some of the redevelopment objectives that are showing in the Midtown and the neighborhood center's plans. That same concept carries forward up the corridor at different scales. We have also introduced in a couple of places, Hilton Heights and at Ashwood Road, some overcrossings that are really dealing with trying to get people, pedestrians and bicycles across the corridor and to eliminate signalized crossings on US 29 to avoid some of the backup and delay-related issues to some of these more widely spaced intersections. Ashwood, if you think about it, is the first intersection north of the river, of the South Fork of the river. It's currently the source of a lot of delay, simply from the standpoint that it's in the middle of a rural section of the roadway where speeds are high and by not having that crossover, essentially eliminating it through this elevated section, those levels of delay and the movement of traffic along 29 would be able to be made much more uniformly through this segment. similar characteristics show up at some of the other smaller overcrossings. And these have been strategically placed in a minute as we look at the pedestrian and bicycle network. Moving into the Hollybean area and the Airport and Timberwood Drive area, this is the other place where we're suggesting that overcrossings of the same type would be appropriate to be able to provide both for connectivity across US 29, but also to provide for movement along the corridor, dealing with a couple of very closely spaced intersections to avoid that. What you also see in the diagrams here are those sections of 29 where widening would be proposed in the area north of Airport up to the Lewis and Clark, essentially, where the existing four-lane rural would need to become a six-lane rural in the 20 years time period, as well as that stretch that I had mentioned from Hollymead Town Center south down to the Polo Grounds area. We have been, as part of the overall process, and have also been looking at some fairly sophisticated operations modeling. We have gone through and done level of service analysis at most of the intersections and then have moved and migrated that operations analysis into the same type of simulation model that we used in the 29H250 project and have essentially worked through that. We have that if it's something you'd like to look at later. But what we've done is summarize those into a series of travel time comparisons that you would see in the corridor. There's a companion set of these that are in the 29H250 work, and that data is actually embedded within these overall runs because we're looking at a network that extends all the way from the Greene County line all the way down to the US 250 bypass and as far north as Barracks on the 250 bypass. What we're seeing here is that the future volumes, with the improvements that we've been talking about that are included in the overall plan right now, would allow us to see a future travel time that's very similar to existing travel times. This despite the fact that in that future scenario, there's almost twice as much traffic on US 29 in some places. Not quite, but in some places it's in between a 50 to 100% increase in movement volume. The key to the overall process has to do with eliminating some of the signalized intersections on 29 through this concept of crossovers and grade separations, as well as the widenings that we were showing earlier in the process. The other component of that is the parallel network and the fact that the modeling that we were doing from a forecast standpoint is indicating that the ability of the parallel network to take some of the local trips off of US 29 is very, very important. To the extent that it really represents almost a lane to another lane and a half worth of traffic that can be removed, that never gets onto 29. So it's very important in the overall scheme of things. We have included in this slide the orange bars, which represent sort of the no-build future condition. In other words, if we took all the future volume and put it on the existing roadway network, you would expect to see something that has 3 to 4 times as much delay as you have today. It's not a condition that you would ever allow to develop, but that's what we wanted to put it in for comparative purposes. The network of parallel roads, as I was mentioning, was very important. This is something we've been working with you on for a while now, but it tends to be reinforced by looking at the volume projections, looking at how traffic distributes over the network, and then how those pieces go together. One of the really important aspects of it is, and that we were trying to stress with people as they look at it, is that these parallel routes are not designed to the same level of intensity as US 29 is. They're really looked at as more local streets. So they have lower speeds, they have different cross sections, and they tend to be more focused on pedestrian and bicycle movement because they really do provide the framework for moving those modes through the corridor up and down, as well as some of the transit connections. Even on 29, though, there is provision being made to address bicycle and pedestrian movement. You'll notice on the green infrastructure map that in the northern portions of the corridor, there is a multi-use path that's detailed along the corridor. This would provide for two-way bicycle movement along one side of the road. Sidewalks are being estimated as part of the cross-section where they're not currently in place in the southern portions of the corridor, and so there's a uniform level of connectivity being provided along 29 for pedestrians and bicycles. Similarly, as Phil mentioned, we've been working with the transit system in terms of the applicable types of transit that might be able to work on the corridor as well as provide circulation in the activity centers. Those range from bus rapid transit to streetcars and local circulation. The concept that we've been working with has to do with, as Phil mentioned, the bus rapid transit on US 29 supported by circulators. It may be developed in a two-stage system, one of which would go as far as the Rio Road Midtown area in the initial stages, and then that would ultimately extend into the airport area, the University's Foundation's Research Park, as well as up to the Northern Employment Centers at NGIC and the GE FANUC areas there. So it's the basic backbone of the system and how it would go together from a transit standpoint. The pedestrian and bicycle accessibility has been a very major component of working through the pieces. Phil had mentioned those in the Green Infrastructure Plan. We've tried to put a little bit more detail to it within the overall transportation framework, focusing on this, one of the key issues is the connectivity across US 29. This is where the situation of going with a selected set of grade crossings at intersections, at key intersections, as well as some underpass and other natural crossing opportunities that we'd be able to see, such as the North Fork of the Ravana River, would give us the opportunity to provide this level of grade-separated crossing on the corridor. That would be complemented by a series of at-grade crossings, better signalization, better notification for bicyclists and motorists where bicycles and pedestrians could cross the corridor at grade. And in those areas where those opportunities aren't present, then it would be the opportunity to develop some pedestrian and bicycle bridge crossings. What we have is one scheduled in the area just next to where Berkmar comes into US 29, right near the Fashion Square Mall. This is part of the overall Rio Ring Road crossing and would be, as we see it, put together in relation to the bus transit system as well. So this is a view of where Berkmar comes into US 29. You're looking at Fashion Square on the far side of the picture. This crossing would be developed taking advantage of the topography on the east side of the road, but on the west side you'd need to be able to get to grade, which would require more ramping. This ramping, we're suggesting, could be taken up within a structure that would actually be part of a parking facility that would be linked to the transit system. This is what it would look like if you were able to populate it with the type of development patterns that are called for in the Midtown area, and this is what it would look like once it's greened out with the trees. The questions that we asked people to address for us last night really had to do, since we didn't have alternatives within the transportation network, but really was asking them to focus on what they thought of how we'd approach the strategy as a whole, because it is made up of a series of parts. And so we were trying to elicit their thinking in terms of which pieces were working for them, which ones might not. And I think we've been successful in getting them to tell us quite a bit of information about the system at this point. I'm going to turn it back to Phil, and we'll talk to you a little bit about how the implementation and priorities worked out.
So the last thing that we wanted the public to think about last night and that we've been starting to think about with working with staff is how do we implement this and how do we move it forward? One of the issues that begins to frame this discussion, though, how does it happen incrementally and phase, is to get an understanding of how the plan fits within projected growth and what might the development capacity of the plan be. So one of the places to start with there is not just the existing development that's on the ground today, but also getting an understanding of the development that's already been approved in the corridor, some of which is now coming out of the ground. We also then, for comparison purposes, have done some analysis with the county of what the current comprehensive plan would support in the Places 29 area. So starting with expected growth and looking at the planning horizon for the plan out to 2025, existing in the corridor today, there's about 14,000 dwelling units and just under 16,000 jobs. Those approved developments add up to about 3,000 dwelling units and about 14,000 additional jobs. Now, the state of Virginia does projections for dwelling units and the county, looking at that and looking at the economic growth of different areas of the county, looks at job growth. And so the numbers that have been analyzed in the traffic work are based on a set of 2025 projections. And that would mean that on the order of 4,000 additional dwelling units would be built in the corridor and just under 10,000 additional jobs. So the total that we're planning for by 2025 would be about 21,000 dwelling units and just under 40,000 jobs. So how does that compare to plan capacity? Now, this is an important issue for people. We've heard quite a bit in terms of some of the reaction to the CRES-A plan as it's been building out. So we wanted to look at what is the capacity of the plan as we've developed it to date. And you see here the two green lines. This is looking at dwelling units. The 14,200 that was on the ground in 2005, and then that 2025 growth projection of 21,000. Oop. What did I know? Let's see what I did. So what we did is looked at all of the land use classifications in the comprehensive plan and in the Places 29 plan have a low end of density and a high end of density. So we looked at those to start with. So the comprehensive plan has about 29,000 in terms of residential capacity if everything was built at that lower end beyond existing development. So this is existing development is in that 29,000, but we're taking its capacity to be the capacity that's there for some of the major existing neighborhoods like the neighborhoods to the east in the south part of the corridor, Forest Lakes, it's mostly there. There's a little bit of Forest Lakes that's still to be developed, but most of it is developed already. Then in the Places 29 plan, it's around 28,000. So very similar in terms of residential capacity on the low end and also on the high end. So if everything that had the potential to develop in the comprehensive plan developed at the maximum level, you could have as much as 67,000 dwelling units. Pretty similar number for the Places 29 plan. It's a little bit higher primarily because of being more specific about the potential for residential and the mixed-use centers and some of the higher densities that are set in some of those centers. Now, the thing is I don't know of any place, particularly at this scale, where the maximum level of the comprehensive plan is actually what gets built. We just don't see that in the way that the economics of development and planning work. So to help give another perspective on this, we looked at the midpoints. So if everything that was out there that could be developed at the midpoint of its density range, it would be a fairly similar number between the two, just a bit under 50,000. Now, it's more than likely that what you would see developing over time is something that's around that mid-range, maybe a little bit lower. The other thing that we reminded the public is, this now we're talking out past 20 years. We're getting quite theoretical about what might build. But also, in terms of the planning process, every 5 years, planning staff comes back to you and to the Board of Supervisors and gives you an update on what's happening with these plans. So there's the opportunity over time to fine-tune and steer the plan, making sure that it's consistent with the community's vision for what they want to see in the area as you move forward and implement. We also looked at employment. Similar story with employment on the one hand, but on the other hand, the thing that's interesting here, and I'll just get all three of these up, is that the existing comprehensive plan is quite a bit higher than the Places 29 plan in terms of employment capacity. But then again, looking at how much beyond the 20-year projection, there's still quite a bit beyond the 20-year projection in Places 29. Now, how has that happened? Well, one of the things that we see throughout the United States in terms of employment designations in long-range plans is that communities are very interested and very aggressive about getting employment, about getting retail, and there's all those economic reasons that it makes sense to do that from one perspective. On the other hand, in terms of the transportation goals, the livability goals, and a lot of these other goals that you have in your comprehensive plan, in the neighborhood model, and now in the Places 29 plan, we want to be more intentional about where those retail and employment uses are. So that's part of the reason that you see this lower capacity in terms of the Places 29 plan compared with the comprehensive plan. Then one of the things that we said to the community is, well, and this is something that you'll need to think about as we think about implementation of the plan, is so we've seen that given the developments that are already approved, a lot of the next 20 years of development might be able to be accommodated within those. But there's still some additional housing that might be needed and some additional employment. So one of the things to then think about is, well, is there a way to think about prioritizing some areas through investment by the county and targeting transportation improvements, doing additional planning efforts? Now, in the framework plan, we've illustrated two candidates for these areas. One of them is the area around the Uptown and Airport Road, where there is a little bit more of a complex system of these mixed-use centers and some important transportation improvements. And then around Rio Road, there's a similar cluster of centers and transportation improvements. So maybe those are places that the county could think about in the next step, focusing on some additional planning. But what about some of the other areas, the area along Berkmar, where there is quite a bit of existing retail development? Do we want to think about that more, and other areas around both the north and the south? What about some of those smaller centers, both in terms of some of the existing neighborhoods, but also as new neighborhoods develop in the north? Maybe that's a place to focus some effort. And so what we did is ask people to go through an exercise where they would circle on the map and note what their priorities might be in terms of those investments in land use planning. Let me turn it back to Fred to talk about some of the transportation priority choices.
Thanks, Phil. What we tried to emphasize last night in terms of people's thoughts about the priority on transportation had to do with some of the related elements of the corridor, and the fact that some of the pieces in work that we'd done on the south end of the corridor indicated that it possibly there it goes the interchange improvements at 29 and 250, the additional ramp by the Best Buy, probably had a very high priority in terms of being able to address current congestion in the corridor. Development of Hillsdale probably is maybe the next step of the piece here. But then after that, the issue of when some of the interchange improvements might be needed, when are the other parallel network components might want to come in, were really something that people needed to be thinking about, because in some of these situations, once some of the immediate bottlenecks at the south end of the corridor have been addressed, then the timing on the other components really becomes dependent upon how much of the network is available. If you build more parallel network in the short term, you then have the ability for it to be better used while 29 continues to operate at about the same level as it has been. Other areas are if you start putting in grade crossings or improving Rio Road into a crossover of some sort, then you begin to accelerate different aspects of the program. But what we wanted people to take away from this is that you have a series of component projects here. It isn't one very large do it all or do nothing. It's essentially you have a whole bunch of pieces that need to be put together, and they can be put together in a couple of different ways. So we tried to explain to them that in a shorthand fashion. We then used some thoughts about cost to begin to illustrate how and why you wouldn't want to do it all at once, and how the fact that it needs to go together in different places. What we were trying to illustrate with this slide is that the cost components in the corridor are made up of several pieces. The light-colored bars represent those roadway improvements that in the south end of the corridor are pretty much represented by the improvements south of Hydraulic or south of Greenbrier along 29 to be able to support some of the interchange improvements at 29 and US 250. There are then four interchange proposals in the southern section of the corridor, each of which could be constructed independently. And then there are the parallel road systems. In the southern part of the corridor, this is primarily Hydraulic and the improvements around Rio Road, both of which would be able to be segregated or separated into separate project-level types of activities. We then also indicated sort of the relative cost of the BRT system, and you'll see that it's the same in both the northern and southern section of the corridors. This has to do mainly with a distance-based issue, in that the distance from downtown Charlottesville to the Rio Road area is about half of the distance from downtown Charlottesville to the airport area as you measure it out. And so the actual incremental cost between those two pieces from a transit system would be about the same in both the northern section and the southern section of the corridor. As we move north of the South Fork of the river, essentially north of Polo Grounds, the US 29 improvements become two, two pieces, essentially. There's the widenings that would need to take place between Polo Grounds and Hollymead Town Center area, and the widenings from Airport up to the North Fork of the river. There are also some incidental intersection widenings as far north as Fraser Mill or Burnley Station Road. But basically, if you think about the US 29 roadway improvements in the northern portion of the corridor, it's two projects. There are three grade separations that are included in the northern section. Those are shown separately here, again, because they would be able to be accomplished separately, although the Airport and Timberwood ones would want to be done at the same time. The parallel road network in the northern section of the corridor is a little bit proportionally more expensive because of the nature of Berkmar and the Berkmar extension across the South Fork of the river. The bridge in that is expensive as a unit that doesn't exist south of the river, and so that's why that one bar is large there. What we were looking at this and thinking about it as you went through this is that there are some interchange priorities that need to be brought forward, such as 29 and the US 250 bypass, but most of the other interchange components are probably things that would happen in the latter half of the planning period. The work we did for 29-250 indicated that the hydraulic interchange would not technically be needed until sometime after about 15 years. So as you think of staging these things over a 20-year or 15-year time period, that's the concept we wanted people to think about and tried to reinforce that with them. And then we essentially brought this forward from a question standpoint. These are the questions we asked them, and they were really trying to get them to focus on putting some more emphasis on when they wanted to see things occur, what their thoughts were on timing, and those then led to some of the questions that Judy had or the responses that Judy had shared with you earlier today in terms of which they had told us those. Do we have any more slides, Phil, or is that it? There's one more question. Okay. What we also tried to work with them on, we dropped a couple of slides out of the presentation here, but we had basically tried to get people to focus on the fact that we were showing them two different sets of improvement strategies here, or not strategies, but essentially levels of improvement. There are regional improvements that are included in the transportation plan. There are county-level priorities, county improvements that are focused on the framework plan. And they needed to be careful as they thought through the prioritization process here to begin to distinguish between what might be more appropriate to the regional funding priorities as opposed to what the county might want to be doing parallel to the regional funding. And so that's why we tried to structure the questions to be able to do that. That's it. Turn it back to Judy.
So we'd like to have your questions and your comments, and I'm going to put the consultants up here since they were the ones that are here in town for this particular event. And then if we need to add anything, Harrison or I will chip in. So. Step right up, consultant.
I was really enamored with the stormwater, the way you were handling that, and wondered if this is something that will be in some kind of prose in the plan or what. It looked like you were doing LID stuff, and would there be suggestions? And Jack, you want to come up and see, is that something that we can implement?
Well, we are. That'll be something that will be dealt with in the unified design guidelines, most likely, that part of the plan, and then we'll also speak to some of the implementation issues that would need to be taken into account with that. So we're going to work with staff to get fairly specific about those, both in terms of roadways but also site development.
Well, what I hear from developers all the time is that we can't do it because of whatever reason it is. And I guess what I want to hear from Jack is that are there ways that we can implement some of this stuff soon instead of five or 10 or 20 years.
We're very interested in seeing what they're going to be providing us in this part of the plan, and some real-life examples of where it's being done, so we could try to find out, well, what are the issues with maintenance, you know, of these facilities? Who's maintaining them? Are they being privately maintained? Are they being publicly maintained? And what are the issues regarding the location of these facilities within right-of-ways? I know one of the biggest issues that we've had with stormwater management is, you know, VDOT has never wanted them within the public right-of-way. They've always had to be beyond it. So it's going to be very interesting to see what examples are out there, how those issues are being dealt with, and especially as our areas become, you know, more urbanized, you know, we need to try to be a little bit more open-minded to try to implement some of these ideas.
Have you seen John Paul Jones area within the parking lot, and they have an unbelievable stormwater system, and it's
sure.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if is it something that VDOT does not want to take in their system? I'm talking to you. Okay.
Marcia, this is so dear to our hearts that we, you know, wanted to mention that I think that was actually one of the things that Phil covered in his presentation, one of the minor reasons for selection of this team because of their prior work on it. When we showed these diagrams in 29H250, we actually met out on site and discussed in the charrette with both city and county engineer. I think Tony Edwards was up with us, Jack, and so both city and county are trying to figure out how to apply this. We actually met with some city leadership today on kind of reviewing this project, and they are seeing people bring in some, you know, permeable pavement proposals. You know, again, it's easier to do in a parking lot. I will commit to run this up both VDOT chain as well as, you know, up to Secretary Bryan on the state side and environmental resources to see what the obstacles are, if any. But I think that I do want to mention that it's so popular that we've incorporated, and thank you, Phil, for those drawings, we've incorporated those green drawing concepts in several of our community plans out in the rural areas, Lake Monticello, Nelson County. People want to see these kind of ideas implemented.
And we have in the work that we've done dealt with both local agencies, also state and federal permitting issues for these kinds of improvements. We've done work that's been funded through EPA for several communities, did the Green Streets Guidelines for the Portland region in Oregon. So we know a lot of those issues, and we'll be working with staff and with VDOT to give them the kinds of resources so that they can make some educated decisions, because there is a tendency as some of this has started to be developed, a lot of what starts being heard about in the engineering field is where there have been problems. And so we can work with them to help them not only find out what those problems are, but what the solutions are.
I'm just afraid we put it in our comp plan and then we can't implement it. Right. So
I don't know whether this question is for you, Phil, or whether it's for Fred, but I just noticed on the map and on the presentation, heavy emphasis on parallel routes on the western side of 29, very, very little on the eastern side, and virtually nothing until beyond 225. And why?
I'll start it. Actually, it really has to do with what section of the map you're working with, because in the area south of the South Fork, well, as we get south of Rio in the Albemarle Square, and we go back to that map, we actually have a relatively balanced system on the east and the west side that's beginning to develop sort of from Albemarle Square south. There is the possibility of being able to get that network up as far as the Woodbrook and Carsbrook component in here, to be able to provide it on the east side using Hillsdale and some of the other connectors in here. We have the Berkmar connections on the west side, as well as the infill of routes down through the area into where Albemarle Place is going in. So it's really a topography-based kind of a component. As we get north of Woodbrook and Carsbrook on the east side, we're running out of the opportunity to be able to get roads in between the roads and the bluff. We were able to accomplish a crossover at Hilton Heights, but that actually requires quite a bit of an elevated road development because the bluff is so close to on the west side of the roadway there. So the opportunities were then pushed to the west side of the road. Moving to the north of the South Fork of the river, those opportunities have a lot to do with the existing development pattern, what's yet to be developed, and where opportunities to be able to provide those connections are. So that's where the Brookmar extended connection that runs through here really is the main centerpiece of the parallel route system in the area north of the river until we get to Airport Road, at which point we're able to this is not work. There it is. Once we get up to Airport Road area, sort of Hollymead North, you're able then to be able to pick up a parallel road system through North Point up as far as Lewis and Clark. Once we get beyond Lewis and Clark and cross the North Fork of the river, the demand pattern changes drastically. We're into a lower volume pattern, and we're into much less of a development possibility on either side of the corridor, and so we're back to 29 as being more of the route that we see as it moves north through Greene County and that area, and the parallel routes appear, for at least from the modeling, to be less important in that particular stretch to the north end of the corridor. So we've tried to balance it out, given the relationships with topography, the opportunity with development, and to be able to fit the framework in at this point. So that's kind of the long answer.
Yeah, I need to jump in here because I happen to agree with Cal's concern here. I mentioned it the last time we had a little session. And I'm, you know, I can't help but visualize what's going to happen to these parallel routes over time. And they will develop as hoped for with some of your visualizations, which I think are very creative and very nice to see. But basically, because of the existing development, unless I'm hearing something wrong, because of the existing development north of the river, we are just shying away from putting any parallel routes there. Now, that's where most of the population lives on the 29 corridor, is on the east side. And there will be no relief for those folks or for those neighborhoods to get around locally, which the whole concept of the parallel routes were intended for. And I'm concerned. I know that Harrison's studies and some of the studies that have been projected of what's happening right now with the population base, that really the logjam is south of the river. But frankly, I think that's going to change rather quickly. And I am concerned that if we don't give some parallel relief on both sides, we will be pushing most of the future development onto the west side, which unfortunately is pushing more and more of it into towards the rural areas and towards our reservoir. So I have some real concerns about what is evolved here, and I guess I need more convincing to put my concerns aside.
Let's take the time to address that in some detail. I want Fred to actually talk about the modeling and how we modeled some other routes and the alternatives for a minute. But in terms of the choice, just looking at the we did start out with an assumption in this plan of respecting existing neighborhoods. And, the tendency is to put the new routes through areas that have not yet been developed. But for, say, these folks here, you know, in Forest Lakes, we heard from many of them. We actually did have a couple, you know, minor roads through there to give them more choice, and we met with the neighborhoods and folks said we don't really need that. So one of the things that gives them more choice is these grade separations at Ashwood and here up in the airport area gives them the ability to access the Berkmar Road to access, you know, not only a slower trip to downtown, but to get to the shopping destinations and some of the things over there. So the grade separations do allow for that. I think, Fred, you know, why don't you address the other routes that we modeled and how the modeling supports the ultimate choice here?
Well, what Harrison's mentioning is that we did look at a series of further out routes, essentially a route that would, it's essentially ones that run on the far eastern side connecting into Profit Road, connecting back into the north end of the network, similar to the way Dickerson and Earliesville we remodeled as part of a bypass concept. Oh, sorry. Sure.
That would be great.
One of them is essentially a connection that would have run through here up through Piney Mountain into the, in, I think it, I can't remember exactly where it looped back in, but the idea was to be able to bring this connection all the way north across the river and bring that all the way up along here so that we had a parallel road system running on the east side of the corridor that would look similar to the essentially the parallel road system that you're able to see through Earliesville and Dickerson on the west side of the corridor. Looking at both of those, well, those were modeled independently to try to determine just how much traffic those connections would be able to attract, what would they essentially pull from a volume standpoint, and would that volume be a cost-effective means. In other words, the cost of the road justify with the level of traffic that could use that road justify the cost to put it in place. And what we were seeing is that, as with on the western side, as we move away from the immediate environs of 29, as we move out to the longer distance routes, the slower speeds and the longer distances that are being involved tend to depress the amount of traffic that is taken off of 29 or out of the 29 core area along the corridor here to use those routes, whether it's on the west side or whether it's on the east side, even connecting directly into the Meadow Creek Parkway. The utility of those roads just wasn't borne out by the amount of traffic that would be generated on them. So,
did you model any closer in? Did you model something that could parallel the Berkmar extension, which I think is going to provide a lot of local relief on the east side? Did you look at something along that line?
Yes, we did. We looked at the one as far as Ashwood. This connection that goes in here, there was a connection that links all the way north up into where Worth Crossing and would be the North Point, I can't think of the name of that road, connects into it there. So we do have those volumes working through here. As Harrison mentioned, yes, we did model them, but they were taken out of consideration given the discussions with the neighborhoods in those areas. We know how much traffic this particular connector develops, the one between Ashwood and Polo Grounds. It's highly dependent upon the connection across the river and making sure that you actually have an effective connection into the network under the south to be able to address the volume of traffic moving. So until something is resolved in terms of Polo Grounds and the development of a connection across the river on the east side of 29, this immediate network in this vicinity does not attract that much traffic. But once you make those connections, then this becomes a more viable route. So it's something that, as you plan further forward here and are able to resolve those crossing issues on the east side of the corridor, then you may want to continue to consider making those connections of a parallel route system through that area immediately east of 29.
We'd be glad to provide you with those numbers.
I'm delighted to hear that the modeling, at least, you didn't say what that modeling showed as far as traffic considerations. It sounds like the political pressure being applied by residents on the east side has vetoed the planning process, and I'm a little troubled that that's the way it's playing out, because I think that should occur after the best plan is developed, not as the plan's being developed. And so I'm having some trouble with that process. I think, you know, that's what we have public hearings for. And certainly there are people on the west side who probably have anxieties. So we've heard a lot from the folks about the Dickerson Road as a further out parallel route, and certainly their concerns are just as valid. There may not be the density on the west side to make quite as much noise, but that's, you know, when we actually have development areas, and our job as a commission is to try to figure out a way to push the comprehensive plan, which says we need to develop in the development areas, we need to make them work, and for an existing infrastructure that developed 30, 40 years ago to veto our opportunity to at least do good planning worries me, and that appears to be what's happened here. So,
well, I wanted to come back to the land use issue, because Fred touched on this, and I think it's really important that there's some fundamental differences in the relationship of Berkmar Extended and the way that it functions, both from a transportation standpoint, but in terms of the land use plan and the way that some of the eastern options function. So let me point to some of this here. So if the one concept that was looked at and analyzed that Fred was talking about looked at bringing a road through this area and connecting in. Now, one of the things with that is what it's doing is providing that more of a local connection, because it stops at Polo Grounds. We never really looked at an option that would have brought it more directly across the river at this point, because there really isn't a transportation network that exists in this area to plug that into. So that's what's led to the idea, to a degree, of Northern Free State Road doing this. But then when you think about Northern Free State Road and coming down through this area, basically once you reach this end of the neighborhood here, given the pattern of development, the floodplain, and the railroad, there's no connection that can be made between developed areas and this roadway. So you're building a road that is in some ways similar to portions of Earliesville or Dickerson at this edge, where it really, if anything, it would be at a local level serving rural development, but the rural development patterns that are here are already focused on their own local access. So this, from this point coming up and north, and then we looked at some connections, I think, that came more this way and tied in and went further north. What you're really doing is recreating a version of Earliesville and Dickerson that's even more removed from the development area.
That doesn't surprise me at all, that model. No, what I was hoping to see was some parallel route that was in close enough that it could, in fact, siphon off some of the local traffic, which continues to clog 29, which is why we have this problem.
While there is some potential for this road, and I can't remember either what the numbers were, the part of what's going on here is that all of this area, with the exception of this area here, all of this is already developed. So it doesn't, given the densities and intensities of development that are in this area, it doesn't have the potential demand that this area has. There's a large employment area that's developing here. There's the Hollymead Town Center. There's other denser development that's on this side. So that's another one of the reasons that it makes sense for the expense of Berkmar and the bridge is both the larger Places 29 function that it's serving, but it's also serving some of the denser northern development where most of what is already existing on this side is much lower intensity. So it was some of those analyses of the number, the amount of traffic that those connections were taking, plus the cost of those improvements, and then on top of that, some of the pushback from the neighborhoods.
Well, I mean, maybe I don't want to beat it, but I'm now seeing this plan in a new light. Following the comments that were made, and I guess what I see now, and this is a function of several factors, including the historical pattern of development, but what I see now is a densification of development on the west side of 29 that's got very dense development or much denser development up against the boundaries of the rural area. So I do sense intuitively, this is not a considered or well-informed, but I do sense intuitively that's going to push a lot more pressure on the rural areas to the west, which are some of the prime areas we're trying to protect. And I don't know whether you all have thought about that and how you contain that at the same time you're creating dense development in those areas and basically leaving areas on the many of the areas on the east side of 29 alone at a relatively non-dense level. That's just a general question, if you've thought about it, or have some reassurance for us that we can reasonably expect to hold that line in the future.
Well, to me, the issue of holding the boundary of the development area, there are particulars about some. I mean, some of the things on the northern. Now I'm getting turned around on the map. On the western side, the airport provides a pretty strong edge for a large portion of the Hollymead area, most of this area through here is either has fairly significant environmental constraints or is already developed in a rural lotting pattern. Similarly, in this area, here you very quickly get up to the reservoir. Again, there's strong reasons to hold that edge. Here, it's really that, again, the combination of the railroad and the extent of the existing development is providing that edge. Where there were opportunities for denser development, either with North Point, it's already being proposed and approved. Up in the Piney Mountain area, this area building off of the expansion of NGIC with an employment area, and then having a fairly significant area of the urban density housing here, organized around a neighborhood center. So where those opportunities existed, we took advantage of those, I think. And then here, you know, the idea of transitioning to some degree density towards the edge, but there still will be pressure on, you know, over time on a number of these edges, and you know, may well be on this side as well. But I think those issues about plan capacity and holding to the vision of the comprehensive plan are, at some level, they're always at risk. You and the Board of Supervisors can make those decisions.
So I would expect that would be your answer. You know, yeah, you guys figure it out.
But I think, you know, you have to come back to the capacity issue, that there is a lot of capacity in this plan. There's a lot of capacity in the existing comprehensive plan. And so,
in capacity that's to be built out over time.
That can be built out over time.
Pressures aren't going to be intense and immediate, or at least
they probably will be.
Yeah. Not
but
as
you need, but there needs to be a logic that you can formulate about, you know, wrong place, wrong time to think about changing the boundary.
One thing I think we need to remember is, first of all, there's been in existence in the comp plan for some time this boundary that has some fair density going up against the edge. It has already been there. And you've made a lot of decisions consistent with that. I don't think this is changing that. I think the neighborhood model also, in one of its principles, defined the need to establish the clear boundary, that you incorporate that in how you make your decisions on land use, but that it didn't have to be, it wasn't about kind of lowering density until you were kind of out in the rural area. There could be some boundaries that were fairly distinct.
I agree entirely, and what this does is just bring home in visual form the intensity of what we expect or are planning for in the growth area versus the pastoral landscape that we want to see immediately on the other side of that boundary.
Kind of like driving down Hydraulic Road.
Right.
And seeing one side versus the other.
Yeah.
Hydraulic Road hasn't changed in the plan in terms of intensity, and it's one of our densest boundaries in the comp plan.
Simulations, what is so wonderful is the first one you show all the power lines are gone. I mean, are you going to speak to that in, is that something that will be, in the pros in the comp plan so that we can maybe encourage that to happen, or?
We've actually, we just unveiled all of those street sections. I forget how many we have. There's pages and pages, 20 or 30 different sections. You know, I think you saw those. We've actually been getting some comments back. I got a marked-up plan from one local professional today, and one of his comments was about the need to work with VDOT to permit not only the utility lines, but even our water and sewer lines in the roadway, so we're not having to have them outside of the right-of-way. So we expect that we're going to have conversations not only with, this is one time, John, where we don't have to pick only on VDOT for permission, but even with our own water and sewer utilities. We actually just, in meeting with city leadership today, said, well, what about future gas mains from the city utilities? You know, where are we going to accommodate those? So we expect that we're going to be meeting over the coming months with both our own water and sewer utilities, city on gas, VDOT on that, as well as, you know, Dominion and the electric providers, about how to get those into the roadway in a more of an urban setting as opposed to the rural setting we've been used to seeing.
That would be great. Then we can maybe have some streets. have you guys thought about how the uptown is going to compete with Hollymead Town Center? I guess I've – or do you see it not competing? I mean, it's so close, but do you see that this is going to be so far in the future that it's not going to be?
It's not only a timing issue, but it's the types of uses that we're thinking about. That they should actually be complementary, that – people will be drawn to Hollymead Town Center for some of, you know, Target, other types of shopping opportunities. But then right next door, they'd have the opportunity to maybe make the decision of, well, you know, gosh, while I'm here, maybe I should go to the restaurant that's over in the uptown, the movie theater. There might be other kinds of lifestyle retail that may be there or maybe in North Point. So again, the idea of the circulator and from a transit perspective and the roadway network that we're looking at in both the airport and the Rio Road areas is the idea of creating ways to link up places that have slightly different focuses, but they can feed off of each other and work in a more symbiotic relationship. So differentiation, probably some competition, but enough variation in the kinds of uses that are there that they should complement each other.
The other thing I was looking at is the employment, which was interesting because it looks as if we're losing jobs from the old comp plan to the new one, and I'm wondering, is it because you're taking out industrial? Is it because what was happening there, and what kinds of employment were you looking at that you would be? I mean, was it all retail that we're looking at up there, or is it? What are you looking at?
There we go. Piney Mountain becomes more of a mixed-use place in the Places 29 plan. The uptown is here, which on balance, given the intensity of development, could easily more than balance out the pure employment land. Pretty significant area of industrial here that this is where one of the neighborhoods is, but a big portion of this is also remaining as industrial. But the other thing is when you take areas like this that are in single use, and we didn't, while we held out existing neighborhoods in those estimates and didn't say, well, you know, what if Carsdale redevelops at its densest level that's allowed under the neighborhood density? Didn't do that. But on the other hand, we did look at the retail centers and said, well, what if they, because we do expect those to change and redevelop over time, what if they redeveloped given these designations? And we didn't, the retail designations that are here allow the option of some residential, but the way that these estimates were done, it would assume that would build out as retail and service use. So there are some very significant areas of single use as opposed to mixed use, and that's where it's some of those things around the margin. I mean, the other thing, again, though, is that those levels of employment that are in the comprehensive plan, you may be deferring opportunities for employment that may occur 120 years from now. If you just take those numbers and project employment growth, there's such a supply there that to a degree they're mythical. but the other thing is that it needs to be monitored. I mean, the other thing to consider is the intensities of development that are in these different areas. And there is quite a range in terms of the allowed intensity of development, both in the existing comprehensive plan and in Places 29. And you may find over time that markets are shifting. more. And there may be people that are developing more at that upper end. And then that's where the five-year review process becomes very important. You can take that moment, reflect on, well, how have we seen it project? Those consultants that we had 5 years ago were saying this. What are we seeing is actually being built? And you can work at refining and steering the plan as you go forward.
Show us how we might use the parking lots of Sam's Club or someplace like that. Have you even thought about adaptive reuse to anything in the big buildings like, heaven forbid, GE goes or Injet goes? Is that anything that's even considered at this phase, or is that 10 years from now?
Yeah, that's true. Comdial is an example of that, where it may have an initial use that's a reuse of what's there, but it's an interesting place to think about, because it's really, even though it looks like it's one big building, it's actually several buildings kind of put up next to each other. Those opportunities are there. Again, a lot of the designations that are on all of these uses would allow for somebody to come back in and redevelop an existing site in most cases, in more of a mixed-use land-use pattern. They could either adapt the buildings that are there or redevelop. So there's flexibility in the plan for people to take either path. And the developers would look at, you know, what makes sense from a market standpoint. I could reuse this grocery store that maybe has passed its utility as a grocery store. Albemarle Square has done that with some of the uses that are there. That may continue to make sense over time, or at some point it may make sense to redevelop those. So I think there's a flexibility in the plan to allow people to take either path.
That will be in the PROs, so that...
Yes.
X, Y, or Z. Okay. Had construction costs for... BRT, and hydraulic road was misspelled.
So much for rapidly putting PowerPoint slides together. So.
But what would the construction cost be for BRT? What are you specifically referencing there?
Mainly there, it's probably falls into two categories. One is vehicles, and the other one has to do with facility improvements for stops and accoutrements along the way. It's not for lane mileage or anything like that. It's assumed to be running in mixed traffic, but it would have a certain level of intelligent transportation system improvements that at signals and other locations that would have some incidental cost.
Do you have an estimate for the cost of that bridge at Berkmar? Do you have any sort of wild guess?
It's right around $30 million.
Whoa!
But that's completely based on where we have it drawn right now. So and we're the first to say this as we go through and look at these particulars, is that you need to, there definitely needs to be a much more detailed location design study done to understand how to minimize the cost of that bridge, how to minimize any impacts, slope impacts associated with it, in terms of the height of the crossing across the river valley, as well as how it comes together with the existing development pattern there. So what we're showing is a very long, high bridge right now, and it has a very, as a consequence, it is a large piece of structure, which is where that cost comes from. That happens to be what's in the cost estimate at the moment, but as we qualify it and go forward here, it's one of those areas that needs to be, much more detail needs to be put into to understand. We've tried to look at alternatives. I know that county staff has been helping with that. Jack has some thoughts on some other alternatives that might be, would definitely be lower cost, but it has a lot to do with how the road network would be developed there.
So one more. When we had a rezoning request come before us that showed a very detailed plan of the area around Shoppers World, have you done lots of those? Because they referenced it in regard to their rezoning request, and I wonder how you plan on using those. The Albrecht property?
Let me start, and then I'll let Phil. We haven't had a lot of those that we've done. There were two or three people, property owners, who've come in at various times or who've been asked, if they would allow their property to be used in kind of a theoretical way to show how redevelopment of something might take place, so that we could do a photo sim for it, or so that we could do a little site plan. And the people from Shoppers World and the parcel behind it came in at one point to offer their site and see what we came up with. And we had a couple of proposals. We ran by them, and the consultants can describe in a bit more detail in a second what they actually showed. We did ask them not to use that particular plan in their proposal. We said, have your consultant that you hire yourself, your own consultant, redraw that. And I was rather surprised to hear later, since I'm not actually working on the review of that project, that rezoning, to see it in there. But that we have worked with a couple of them, but not an extensive number.
Mm-hmm. I should mention we also we did work with three or four property owners in the first phases, and so there's a couple locations in the city, and Phil just mentioned the Seminole Square, where we got permission to show some conceptual ones. Some of those have taken, and folks, that's sort of turned into detailed work on the Hillsdale Drive redevelopment approach, too. So sometimes, you come up with concepts, and people run with them before you're even finished with the plan. A little bit of that is out of our control if it's a good idea.
Thank you very much. When will we see you again?
And thank you. We have two neighborhood meetings next week, and we will be bringing back summaries to you of all of the work that, for this particular charrette shortly after that. We expect to have receiving chapters of the plan as well as parts of the transportation study in draft form that we'll be going through, and we'll be scheduling a series of work sessions with you to go over some of the issues that are in them so that you can be familiar with what the text of the plan is going to look like. You've been seeing a lot of maps and a lot of photo simulations and far less text, which obviously is going to be necessary. So we'll be bringing those to you at work sessions for your review, your comment, your questions, and we may have some questions for you as to, do you think you want to see it this way, or would you prefer something different? I would expect those to start in 2 to 3 months. Then we are hoping to have the final draft of the master plan all collected, all together by the end of June, and then finish up with any work sessions and then start through the public review and approval process. We would not want to schedule any public hearings during the summertime, anything like that. But so we're looking to get into that process after Labor Day, and again, this is tentative at this point, but we hope to have it approved by the end of the year. But again, that depends on this commission and, of course, the board's wishes. Thank you.
Yes. Earn the dinner.